things that I'm going to talk about today. One is the geometrical contribution to the entanglement entropy, and the other thing is the tripartite entanglement that I talked to one of you. This talk is going to be based on the following two papers, and for the second one, we are finalizing it and hopefully post it soon. And I collaborated two papers with my PI Shinsei and Yuya is a postdoc from Caltech. Raman is a postdoc from Princeton, and Jonah was a PhD student from Chicago and recently moved to IIS. Okay, so let me first start from something quite broad, that basically what the quantum entanglement can teach us. So say that suppose we compute the entanglement entropy for the topological systems, that the constant piece, which is the topological entanglement entropy, encodes the total quantum dimension for the system. And sometimes we also look at this entanglement spectrum, and when we see the zero modes, that basically says that we have a topological system. And suppose we compute that for the quantum critical point, say in a simple case, for the one dimensional critical point, from the scaling of the entanglement entropy, we can obtain a value for the simple charge. And that is actually a quite effective way to. And say for the other aspect, when we apply the numerical methods like the tensor network, we also need to understand the entanglement structure for the state that we want to represent, and that can help us to choose the proper tensor network structure. And recently, people are also quite interested in something called the entanglement transition, that includes the measurement discrete transition, and then many people studied here, and also the many body localization, the normalization transition. And quantum entanglement also plays an important role in the holographic duality. But then, until this point, we only talk about the so-called tripartite entanglement. So one natural question to ask is that suppose we look at the tripartite entanglements, because like here we want to study some many body systems, so in principle that we can break the total system into more parts. So suppose we want to compute the tripartite entanglements, like what tripartite entanglement can teach us about the different phases of matter. That is the question that we want to have a better understanding. But then, however, little is actually known about the behavior for the tripartite entanglements. So for that, let's take a step back to see what we learned from the tripartite entanglements. So in the simple case, we know how to define the bipartite entanglement matrix, which is the von Neumann entanglement entropy. And then suppose we compute that for the ground state for some gaseous Newtonian, we know that will obey the area law. And that is the thing that it basically counts the number of the bell pairs that cross the entanglement boundary. And as I mentioned before, the constant term encodes the topological entanglement entropy. But then, suppose we want to ask the similar question for the tripartite entanglements, we will see that the answer for these similar questions are actually not so clear. So say that when we take two qubits and they are entangled, and in this case, they will form this bell pair. But then if we take three qubits, the things become more complicated, that there is a famous result saying that the three qubits can be non-trivially entangled in two different ways. So that is why right here they can either from the GHG states or they can from the W states. So that is the case for the 3 qubits. But then if we want to move on.
What is the definition of being different?
You cannot say use the LCC to connect them together. That is the rough definition. It actually appears in the paper back in 2001. And in that paper, they have a weaker version for the LCC, and they use that to define this equivalence.
Did you say LCC?
Yeah.
LCC.
Like the say local operators and the classical communication.
What do you mean by local? Like single site arbitrary. Okay. I see. Thanks.
Yeah. Suppose it's not 3 qubits, but 3 qdits. Is there any result?
I think that maybe in that case it is going to be more complicated, but I cannot say that for sure. Yeah.
So is there a quantity that you can compute for these 3 qubits?
Like is there
like concurrence for 2 qubits, things like that, or entanglement? Say I have 2 different states.
So were you asking that whether we have some quantity that can tell the difference between these 2 states?
Something like
that. Yeah, so that is actually what I'm going to talk about later. Yeah, so it is in the next few slides. Yeah, so that is actually one of the points, because we kind of know that the 3 qubits can be entangled in 2 different ways. So it would be nice to have a quantity that tells the difference between them. Right. So that is related to the third point here, that how to define a proper entanglement methods when we talk about the Shabata entanglements. And also, suppose we compute that on some topological states, what kinds of the topological signature that we can find. So these are still the relatively open question about the Shabata entanglement. Okay, so then let me move on to talk a little bit about the Shabata entanglement methods. So the Shabata entanglement methods also include the mutual information and the logarithmic negativity that probably people are more familiar today. I'm going to focus on a newer quantity that was actually first proposed back in 2019, and it is called the reflective negativity. So here is just some definition for that, and we are going to see the physical interpretation for that later. Okay, so to talk about the definition. So the starting point is that we break the total system into 3 parts, A and B and C, and we trace out C. So with that, we get the reduced density matrix from AB. So that is this rho AB. And with this rho AB, we do the eigen decomposition so that it can be written in the summation for P. And then the next step is to bring this density matrix into a state in the double Hilbert space. So that is kind of similar to the spirit of the thermal field double states. That we first take the square root for this lambda p, and then after that we flip the bra into the cap in the second copy of the Gilbert space. Okay, so now we have a pure state, which is So the second copy of the Hilbert space is kind of like the conjugate for the first copy. So that is why here that we have a star. But in the say numerical calculation, it actually doesn't matter a lot. Because it is the second copy, so you can kind of imagine that you can just choose the basis arbitrarily. Yeah, it doesn't matter a lot. Right. So now that we have a third base, that is supported on A and B, A star and B star. So suppose we trace out the A star and B star, we are going to go back to row AB, that is our starting point. But we can also choose a different way to trace out the subsystem. So here that we choose to trace out the B and B star. And in this way, we will have a reduced density matrix that is supported on A and A star. So that is the row here. And then finally, we compute the form Neumann entanglement entropy by this new density matrix. And that is the definition for this quantity called the reflective entropy.
This may be a common sense question, but I just suddenly got confused. So when you map from row to the cat square root row, is that unique? Do you need to assume something like lambda is degenerate and so on?
No. This mapping is the so-called clarification, and in principle, you can have many different ways to perform this purification. So this choice is the so-called canonical purification. But in principle, you can choose it other ways. As long as that when you trace out the A star and B star, you can go back to the original reduced density matrix, then that's fine.
So for the later part of what you say, does the purification scheme matter, or do you want to stick with this canonical one?
Yeah. So in the later part, I'm going to stick to this size, mostly because it is simple. Yeah. That is the definition. So the next question to ask that why people are interested in this quantity, and depends on which community you ask, people will have different answer. Originally, this quantity is proposed by the high energy community because they want to study the holographic world for a quantity called the entanglement wedge cross section that is basically the blue lines here. So that is the motivation to define this quantity. But because today we are in the condensed matter seminar, so we want to answer this question more from a condensed matter point of view. And the interesting point is that this quantity can actually capture the so-called non-trivial Chabata entanglements, which is basically saying that it can tell the difference between the GHD type entanglement and the W type entanglement. And the W type entanglement is what we call the non-trivial Chabata entanglements. And so in order to do that, we use it to define a relative quantity called the Markov gap, which is basically the difference between reflective entropy and the mutual information. So there are many states that, that are going to give the zero results for the Markov gap. And here I list some of them. So say if you only have the bipartite entanglements, the quantity will be zero. And if you have the G-type tripartite entanglement, it is zero. And, so in this paper, they prove that if you compute this quantity for the Brown state, for the one dimensional gap in Hamiltonian, it is also zero. And also, this quantity will be zero for the stable state, like the Torrey code. It is going to be zero. So it is more interesting to ask that in which case this quantity can be positive. And one of the cases that Markov gap is positive is the W state. And using some methods from CFT, one can also prove that for the Brown state, for the one-dimensional critical system, this quantity will be a constant that is proportional to the central charge. And that is also related to the results in the holographic CFT.
When you say it's zero, is it literally zero, or is there's some finite size correction?
No, so it is going to be strictly zero.
I see.
Yeah, like actually have a proof that this quantity will be strictly zero for the stabilizer states. So it is something that you can rigorously prove that these two just cancels out.
If it's still a that kind of topological order, but perturbed away from solvable point, is it going to be strictly zero, or
I see.
Is it exponentially small or something?
Right. So that is a good point. So in that case, I think. It will have maybe it will have some finite size correction when you add some perturbation, because when you have the perturbation, that is not strictly the stabilizer state.
Right.
Yeah, but I will think about that more later to see that whether we can say something stronger than that. Right. So basically, we have a quite good understanding for the behavior for this quantity in the one-dimensional system.
Can I ask a question? The classical correlation as well, or just quantum correlation?
Yeah, so that's a good point. So actually, suppose you compute that for the separable states, which also carries the classical correlation. So in that case, it is actually positive. So I would say that, unfortunately, this quantity is also sensitive to some classical correlation.
Is it possible to separate the contribution from classical correlation from quantum correlation? By subtracting some amount from the Markov gap.
I see. Yeah, so I think it would be nice to solve that problem, but we don't have that quantity yet, but it would be nice to have that.
So what's the short definition of classical and quantum correlation?
Sorry?
What's the sharp definition of classical and quantum correlation?
What is the
sharp definition of classical and quantum correlation?
I wouldn't call that to be a sharp definition, but one of the cases that you can think about that only has the classical correlation, is what I mentioned before, the separable states. So in that case, that you can write the density matrix to be the summation of several density matrices. So in that case, it is counted as the classical correlation. Yeah, so I think there should be a sharper definition. Yeah. But that is what comes to my mind now. Okay, so from these results that we have a relatively good understanding for the behavior for this quantity for the one-dimensional system. Then one natural question to ask is that how about when we think about the two-dimensional system? And that is the question that we try to answer. Okay, and before we enter into the technical details, let me first show the summary of the results. So as I mentioned before, that we will consider the setting to be a logically Brown state in a 2+1 dimensional system, and we want to compute the tripartite quantities, so we will break the total system specially into three parts. And one of our key results is that even that in the 2+1 dimensional case, the Markov gap still takes a relatively simple form, that it is related to the central charge for this logically outer system.
Which central charge?
Right. So that's a good point, that which central charge. So suppose it is the chiral topological order, then it is the chiral central charge. But then suppose you want to talk about the non-chiral case, it is a little bit tricky. So the conjecture is that for the non-chiral case, suppose you can get out the boundary, then this quantity will be zero. And suppose you cannot get out the boundary, then this quantity will be replaced by the unscattable part of the total central charge.
So here, does ABC extend indefinitely? Or is it, so here we have ABC, are they just some finite disks? Or do they extend indefinitely?
In that case, we actually have the total system as a sphere.
System is the sphere.
Right, yeah. I should mention that before. It is compact. Yeah, so that is actually important because later on that we want to use the bulk boundary correspondence to solve the problem, and suppose it is goes to the infinity space, then probably that is not possible. Like typically we want to define a CFT Bontan circle. Yeah, so that is why we take it to be a sphere, which is convenient.
Why should I expect this Markov gap edge to be some topological invariant at all?
I think we don't.
Okay, it turns out to be a topological
invariant. Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Suppose we really want to prove for you that, then we probably need to reproduce the calculation using T2FT. Right. But I think no one has done that. So I think we cannot say that it is a statistically invariant.
Oh, sorry, just to make sure I understand the statement. So if I have a not completely parabolic order, let's say I have some left par with CL, right par with CR,
mm-hmm.
Let's say if it's still a CFT on the edge. So that C is the, do you say that C should be the total center chart?
Right, yeah.
I see. And if they can gather each other, you say the C can be zero?
Right.
I see. So I should understand this C as the kind of the minimum total center total center charge?
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, so that is what I kind of want to mention here, but we discussed that already. Yeah, so basically if we say want to consider the non-chiral case, then the interpretation for this C should be the ungappable part of the minimal of the total central charge. Exactly. Okay, so that is the result, and then now I'm going to move on to some technical details. So before we say talk about the calculation for the tripartite entanglements, it would be better to move back and have a better understanding for the calculation for the tripartite entanglement. So here that I kind of present that the bipartite entanglements can be computed from two different ways, that we can either compute that from the bulk perspective by the 2 plus 1D DQFT, which is actually what was done initially. But then actually we can also do a interpretation on the 1 plus 1D boundary conformal theory. And the idea is that suppose we care about the universal part, which is here the topological entanglement entropy gamma, they are actually going to give the same results. So people are probably more familiar with the computation from the ALK. So here I'm going to talk a little bit about the computation from the boundary CFT point of view. So the basic idea is that we use a boundary condition to define this boundary state B. And roughly speaking, this boundary condition tells us how can we match this chiral, which is the left moving, and the anti-chiral, which is the right moving copies. So here that we kind of think about a simpler setup, that we take our total system to be a cylinder, and we take the subsystem A to be half of the total cylinder. So in that case, our entanglement cut will be a circle, and we have our boundary CFT supported in that circle. So for the general rational CFT, the solution for this boundary condition actually takes a quite simple form. So here I is the label for the different anions or the so-called different primary operators that can appear in this theory. And for each anion, we can have a different boundary state labeled by I. And basically, the boundary state is a summation for the combination of the chiral and the anti-chiral states in the CFT tower. So you can kind of see that it is like a maximally entangled pair for all the states in the conformal tower. And because here we have an infinite sum, so we cannot actually take this state and then use that to compute like entanglement entropy. So in order to say compute any physical quantity, we will need to do a regularization by using this vector e to the minus eta h. So here the eta is actually the inverse for the mass gap. And because eventually we are interested in the large mass gap limit, which is saying that eventually we will take this eta goes to zero. Okay, so after that, we can take this regular right boundary state E, and then we can trace out the right moving part, and we use the reduced density matrix to compute the entanglement, and that is the so-called left-right entanglement entropy. And after the calculation, one can see that the universal part from the left-right entanglement entropy actually agrees with the result from the 2 plus 1 decalculation. So that kind of manifests the so-called bulk boundary correspondence, which is saying that if we are only interested in the ground state near the entanglement cut, we can approximate that using the boundary state. And people know this for a while.
What is B?
Which one?
B.
Which,
BI. What is it?
Oh, so it is the quantum dimension for the canyon.
Usually, we just say gamma time is capital D.
Right.
Why do we?
Right. So maybe I should mention that before. So say that when you can have the different anions in the system, they say suppose you put a state on the torus, then you will have the ground state degeneracy. So maybe I can, yeah, so that is actually a quite interesting point. So say in the pre, so say when you have a torus, and that kind of depends on how do you choose your subsystem. So suppose you choose your subsystem like this, so that's kind of like a disk, then in that case, the gamma will be just log D for any, say, ground state that is a general superposition for all the possible ground states. But then, however, on the torus, you can also choose a different way to do the partition. Let's say, suppose you cut the torus in this way, and then you cut this part to be your subsystem A, then in that case, we are going to have a similar formula as this gamma prime. That in that case, it is actually sensitive to the superposition coefficient, which is the CI. That kind of depends on how do you choose your subsystem.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused with this setup. So can you remind me again of where is your boundary?
Here?
Yes.
Right. So here that as in this figure that we have our total system to be a cylinder, and we take the subsystem to be half a cylinder. So in that case, the entanglement boundary will be a simple circle. And then in this case, that that we actually have the entanglement boundary to be two copies of the circle. So actually,
I understand the entangling surface is just a boundary of the half line. Just you are dividing a cylinder into two pieces, right? So what do you mean by boundary? I mean the so the original and the Hilbert space is justified for an entire cylinder.
So that is actually, the point here, so that is saying that, say, suppose we want to compute the bipartite entanglement entropy. In that case, only the degrees of freedom near the entanglement boundary will be important in the reduced density matrix. So that is why we can make this approximation that we can use a boundary state which is supported on this entanglement boundary to represent the ground state.
Artificially introducing some boundary, you are identifying a conformal boundary with the entangled boundary of a subregion.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So that is actually the key point for this calculation. That basically we want to find a state that can use to.
Sorry to interrupt you. So if I remember correctly, boundary state is separable in a sense it doesn't have any entanglement entropy. But why do you have entanglement entropy? Not the
what do you mean by that the boundary state is separable?
I'm only familiar with holographic calculation, but in holography, for instance, if you consider boundary state, and if you don't evolve, if you consider no evolution by imaginary time, just a boundary state itself, then
right,
it will lead to just a vanishing entanglement entropy. So,
but then actually, so. Say that, say here, suppose you only take this Shibaki states, I feel it is actually not so clear, say how to compute the entanglement entropy for these states. Because, say that, so, because, this state has been infinite norm. So I feel that in that case, how to compute the entanglement entropy is not so clear for me.
So sorry, what's your definition on gamma prime on the right side of your slide?
Oh, so it is the constant piece in the entanglement entropy. Yeah, so probably I should write that. Yeah, so that is say that the entanglement say it equals to some area lobbies times some factor and then minus a constant piece. Yeah, so the gamma prime is the constant piece. Yeah, and
the
length.
Subregion A inside the region defined for boundary state.
Sorry?
Well, so the boundary state is defined on the Hilbert space only for A, is it correct?
You can say that the chiral part is in A and the anti-chiral part is in the other half cylinder. So that is
okay. I think I've got it.
Do you have to assume the edge theory is fully chiral for this kind of argument?
For this one. So I think typically people will do this calculation for the chiral case because say that for the non-chiral case like the toric code so in that case how to define the boundary state becomes a little bit tricky. So in principle, there are also papers also talk about how to define the boundary state, say, for the models, like the historical, but my impression is that it is not so stable.
I just want to make sure. In the equation of each boundary state, I guess HI labels the primary.
HI.
That labels the primary.
Right, yeah.
What's capital N?
So that is the level.
What is K?
So that is the case that when you can have multiple states at a even level. Yeah, so you can have some degeneracies.
And what is DN?
That is that's the number for the multiple states at a given level.
That's not the quantum dimension.
No. Oh, sorry. Yeah. So probably I shouldn't use the same notation. That is not the quantum dimension. Yeah, that just labels the different states at a given level. Hopefully that this part is clear after the discussion. Right. So the main focus today is how to compute this tripartite entanglements. So following the same logic, then we want to modify the boundary condition and then use that to define the vertex states. And we will use the vertex state to mimic the 2+1 Legrand state near this more complicated entanglement boundary. So just a recap, in the calculation for the tripartite case, the entanglement boundary is a circle, but then if we want to compute the tripartite entanglements, the boundary will be something like a vertex, and that is why we choose to call the state the vertex state. So similarly, the boundary state says how we how we pair the chiral and the anti-chiral copies in a theory. So based on that intuition, we choose to modify the boundary condition in this way. So say that we can take the three copies of the edge theory. So that is say here we have these three lines, and then we use the boundary condition to match them together. So in principle, we can solve the boundary condition to find a solution for this vertex states, and then we can use the vertex states to do the computation for the tripartite entanglement entropy. So in principle, that can be done, but then in practice, that that currently we are only able to find a solution for the vertex state for one of the simple case, which is the pre-Fermion. So that is some technical details that is not going to be important. And then we take the solution for the pre-Fermion vertex state, and we use that to numerically compute the Markov gap. And we find that it actually equals to this quantity quite accurately. So that kind of indicates that maybe there is some general relation that we can say about this Markov gap. So following this result, the next question to ask is that whether it is actually a universal result that we can say for the more general case. Because now that we only have this numerical evidence coming from the free fermion, so that is the question that we want to solve in our second paper. So in principle, it is hard to obtain the better state solution for the general rational safety, but in that case, we can actually compute the entanglement by some test integral. So and then later on, we are going to use that to show that it is actually a quite general result for the rational safety. So I think we don't have a lot of time, so maybe I'm going to go quickly.
Sorry, on the previous slide, but what's HK versus HU?
Oh, so that is some details. So like here that say we have this boundary condition for the free fermion, but in the numerical calculation we also try to solve some more complicated boundary conditions. So that is the label for some so-called mixed boundary condition, which I can show quickly. So in the mixed boundary condition, say that you have say 5-1 minus 5-2 L minus sigma 2 equals to 0 on this space. And then you 2 and 3 also minus I 5-2, 5-3, but then 5-3 plus 5-1. So here that you can change the sign for one of them, and that is what we call the mixed boundary condition. Yeah, so that is the label for the case for the different boundary conditions. And in that case the result doesn't seem to be so universal. So that kind of say
for the third column, when A and B are not contiguous,
right.
When A and B are small, does it approach some universal value? Or maybe I can ask the same thing for the 1 plus 1 CFT.
Mm-hmm.
So there, the result from
right.
at all,
so
contiguous A and B? Or?
Right. Say that suppose A and B are separated. In that case, we actually don't have the universal results because that will be related to a open function in the CFT. But then suppose they are close to each other, that case it can be related to some three-point function. And because it is three-point function, like roughly speaking, it is only going to be dependent on the OP coefficient. So that is universal. So yeah, so in the case 3, I don't think we will have the universal result. Yeah, that's a good point. Right, so I'm probably going to rush. So basically we want to represent the boundary state as a past integral. So as I mentioned before, the boundary condition tells us how to glue the chiral and the anti-chiral copy, and that is the intuition that we will use in the past integral representation. And here we need to do this regularization, and that is going to be represented by some imaginary time evolution along the vertical axis. So using that, we have a past integral representation for the boundary state, which is a cat, and then we can also do the similar thing for the bra. And then after that, we can just put these two together, and that's going to be the past integral for the density matrix. And now that we want to use that to compute the entanglement entropy. So basically say that suppose we want to have a path integral representation for the reduced density matrix, we simply need to take these two, and then here we kind of use a trick to unfold the boundary states, so that becomes a path integral that only includes the chiral copies, and now we want to chase out B, so we simply glue these two gamma B together, and then that becomes a path integral representation for the reduced density matrix. And say, suppose we want to compute the case for this n equals to 3, then we just take 3 copies and then we just glue them together. And doing that, we are going to have a path integral on a torus. So here I use this tilde symbol to represent the periodic boundary condition. So that is why that after the gluing, it will become a torus. And we know how to compute the path integral on a torus. So by definition, that is just a character in a CFT. So we just take the results from the character, and then we use that to compute its entanglement entropy, and in this way we can reproduce the results that we had before. So that is just like a sanity check that the past integral representation is working. So that is the case for the bipartition. And then,
can I ask a question? Yeah, here. So III is a projector onto the holomorphic sector of the.
Right, yeah. Right.
Why do you consider this projector? Sorry.
So basically that, say, do I have it here? So I have that in the previous slide. Basically we just take these boundary states and we kind of say flip the cat in the second copy into the bra.
So the reason is your concept of left right entanglement entropy, so you want to take a partial trace on the
right. So the partial trace is what happens here. That when we glue that to gamma B together, that has the effect of taking the partial trace.
I think I just missed. So the projection operator, the necessity for projection operator is what?
That is when you evaluate this path integral on the torus, and because here you have this projection operator, so the path integral will be related to the character for the NMI.
I'm asking the why do we need to insert projection operator in the first place?
So that is just saying from the boundary states. Because we want to compute this left right entanglement entropy for the boundary states, and what I was saying is that by this treatment, that quantity will be related to a path integral on the torus with the corresponding conformal interface. So the conformal interface will be related to the boundary states that we want to compute the entanglement.
So you insert projection operator in order to take out only the left moving piece?
So I would say that it is a projector on the onion eye, but not say the projector on the Carol copy.
Okay, maybe I will ask.
So is this projector just taking care of the boundary condition you are choosing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, right.
Another question. So suppose now we have a 2 plus 1D topological phase, and on the boundary there's a kind of CFT. Then I do this calculation, I get one answer. But I suppose I consider the same, or but a different boundary, still a kind of CFT, but with different total central charge. The same kind of central charge, but different total central charge. I do the same calculation, what will I obtain?
Right, so I think that I would say that it is safe to apply this method for the chiral case for now. Yeah, I think we haven't fully understand that, say, suppose you take a non-chiral system, like how is it going to enter this calculation?
I'm considering a chiral system. It's just that now the boundary has some it has the chiral part, it also has some anti-chiral part. In total, it's still chiral.
Mm-hmm.
I'm considering that boundary. If
right,
I calculation,
yeah.
I guess I will get a different answer.
So I think that we don't have a good understanding for that situation yet. Yeah, because say this trick that kind of turns everything into the calculation only Carol copy. Yeah, so that is why I feel that we are not quite sure what happened in the situation that you mentioned. Yeah, but it will be interesting to think about that. Okay, so now that we want to use a similar path integral method to compute the tripartite entanglement, we are going to see that it is actually quite complicated because, as I mentioned before, for the tripartite entanglement calculation, it becomes a path integral on a torus, but then in general, if we want to do the computation for the vertex, say, in general, it will become a path integral on some higher genus. And it is also quite tricky to find a path integral on the higher genus. So we are not going to really do that. So we are going to use some trick for the path integral decomposition. And then using that, we basically use the open boundary condition to approximate the closed boundary condition. And then by it is the last slide. So by using that, we can basically turn that to a path integral on two copies of the cylinders, which we know how to compute the path integral, and then we just do the calculations, and here is the results. So the first result is that, say, when we consider the entanglement entropy for a region with a corner, so that is what happens in this figure. So in that case, we found that the entanglement entropy will actually carry a corner term that is related to the angle for this region. So that's quite interesting results. And then we compute the tripartite entanglements.
So P is the angle.
Oh, So say that suppose we break the system into three parts, then p equals to 3. But then in principle, that we can use a similar way to define the p vertex states. Yeah. So that is kind of like say how many parallel copies that we combine together to define the vertex states, and that is equivalent to we partite the total system into p parts.
Sorry, I thought you were writing p equals p.
Yeah. So say that suppose we compute the vertex states, then p equals to 3, and then we can choose say p a equals to 1 and p b equals to 2.
Oh.
Yeah. So so that is the two subsystems that combine together total system. Yeah. So that is the what happened for the entanglement entropy, and then it is quite interesting that that when we compute the tripartite entanglement, it actually has a very similar structure that we have an area law piece, we have a corner piece, and the topological term. But it is quite interesting that the path integral for the reflecting entropy actually carries an abstract piece, and then when we make the difference between these two quantities, we are going to get the Markov gap equals to this abstract piece. So say that, as I mentioned before, in the previous case for the 1+1D stability calculation, the origin for the Markov gap comes from the OP coefficients for some Swiss operators in the CFT. But here that we have a Markov gap that has a different interpretation from the calculation, that it comes from a abstract piece when we perform the path integral. So I think it is quite interesting that it can come in different ways. Okay, so that's just a summary to what I have said before. I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to read it now. Yeah. Thank you for your attention today.
So can I ask, you mentioned that this Markovian gap can distinguish W from C, the other things, GHC and so on. So mm-hmm. What does it look like on W states?
So it is some positive quantity.
Let's say if I have a spin chain with just the W state, so it, you get an L independent size.
Oh, I see.
So,
yeah. That's a good point. I will compute that and then let you know what's that.
For 3, you get some non-zero. For 3, mm-hmm. You get some non-zero number.
Yeah. Right.
And that number is 0 on GC. Okay, yeah, I see. Okay, any other?
So what is the Markov gap? Is it related to Markov chain?
Right. So I remember that it is related to some Markovian recovery process. And if you are interested, they kind of talk about that in this second paper. Yeah. So they also kind of try to give an interpretation for this quantity from a quantum info point of view.
I have another question which Chong already asked, but I want to make sure. So here we are using a particular purification of UAB to define this quantity.
Mm-hmm.
I use another purification, say I just use the original ground state. The same answer or different answer?
Well, you're saying that So basically, you want to put the return seat back. Yeah, so I think in that case, probably you are going to give a different answer because, say, here from the definition that say, we kind of require that, say, the A and A star having the same size and also B and B star having the same size. So in general, that say, suppose that you choose a general pure application, that is not going to be the case. Yeah.
Yeah, I think in the Zolpo paper, they also consider it's, instead of reflected entropy, they consider entanglement of purification, which is like the minimum. It's like the purification that gives you the minimum entanglement across this cut. And apparently that also has some nice properties. Subtract off each one provision.
Right.
I have a related question, so I'm still not convinced of myself with the operational definition, operational meaning of reflected entropy. As for the mutual information, the understanding is really clear in a sense that it comes to correlation between A and B. What does reflected entropy see? And what, so in other words, so what is the operational meaning of Markov chain?
So I agree that like that maybe it is less clear. But then this say canonical purification, you can kind of feel that it is like making a mirror image, say kind of like for the original density matrix. Yeah, but I don't have a better say interpretation beyond that.
And also, I have a question from holography. I think the entanglement cross section has many different
right. Yeah.
Theory.
Many candidates, right?
For instance, if you consider the difference between the negativity and log negativity and this mutual information, then do you obtain a Markov gap like quantity, or this is not universal?
So I think that is going to be a different quantity. But as you mentioned, that I also read some paper that kind of argues that the negativity may also be the holographic dual for the entanglement wedge cross section. Yeah, so I think at this point, because they have a similar behavior in the leading term, so people actually cannot say for sure that.
Yeah, if you just
which quantity.
You cannot tell the difference. But my question is also the Markov gap is does depend on the length scale, right? Just determined by the central charge.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the relation.
If you define some kind of Markov gap like quantity by taking a difference between log negativity and mutual information, does it depend on the subsystem size, or it exhibits similar kind of?
Oh, right. So I don't have the say results for the holographic space, but then say that say suppose you take a many body space, and if you properly define the difference between the negativity and the mutual information, it is also going to be order one. But then in that case, so like here that that say when you increase the size for your subsystem, the Markov gap is going to be the And, but then in that case, that it has some subtle dependence on the subsystem size. So it is order one, but it is not quite clean.
Uh-huh. So in that sense, reflected entropy is probably the
right, yeah. That's right. That is quite interesting, actually.
So is this Markov gap non-negative?
Mm-hmm, right. That you can prove that rigorously.
And is it invalid on the LCC?
Probably not, but I should check that.
If it's not invalid on the LCC, then whether it's zero or not cannot be used to distinguish GHC and W state.
Oh, right. So I think that maybe I wouldn't say that this quantity is a LCC monotone.
Yes, so regarding the law of negativity minus mutual attribution, I think that one can be negative for the double state. I think it's actually negative for two parties. Yeah. It's kind of counterintuitive.
Mm.
Because you'd expect that the mutual information. The mutual information should capture both quantum and classical information, right?
Just a simple difference doesn't make sense because in holography, I think we have log negative three over two times log negativity equals the entire image cross section, something like that. So, so what we should look at is a three over two times log negativity minus mutual information, something.
Right. Yeah.
And in holography, a typical holographic state is not GHC, and it should contain some W state like entanglement. So, but in holography, it is just positive, so like as you shown in the Markov gap case. So, I'm not really sure if it becomes negative.
Yeah, so I think that is also one of the arguments from this second paper that they use the Markov gap to argue that the holographic space carries the non-trivial tripartite entanglement. So they use that to argue that it has a richer structure than what people think before.
By the way, do people know the sufficient and the necessary condition for the Markov gap to be
solved? Right, so I think here is probably the necessary condition, but we don't.
There's an obvious sufficient condition, right? If A and B are disentangled with the rest, I think they.
Mm-hmm.
If it is a pure state disentangled with the rest of the system, then I think this is zero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
But I don't know. That I guess that's not a necessary condition of this hypothesis.
Oh, sorry. So I think I should. Says that it's not a sufficient condition, not the necessary condition.
Okay, another question.
Thank you for your attention.